Session number 3971, reel number 3.
Mr. O'Neill, Reel 3, you are now embarked on board the LCT. What happened next?
Well, after one of the two exercises with the commandos that I described to you, we really just sat on board and did nothing but eat and smoke. We were very plentifully supplied with rations. I think that in the end, the driver of the vehicle I was on and myself, between us, had enough rations to last 10 men for 50 days, so we certainly weren't going to go hungry. And it was actually criminal, because we opened the cases and took out all the cigarettes, as we thought those were the most important, and left the food one side. It was very unpalatable tin food. The tins had wicks on, and you used to light the wick to heat the food up. And we were all very much a self-contained little unit there. There was no, obviously, on a landing craft tank, there was no mess, no communal room or anything. You really lived on the vehicle you were with and got to know the chap next to you. In this case, I got to know the two Navy chief petty officers who were with the chief. And I slept in the back of the vehicles, and they, for instance, they slept on the deck of the landing craft. Luckily, the weather was good, but on the night we were due to set sail, a very heavy swell came up, and most of us who'd been drinking this hot chocolate were quite violently ill, which didn't look good for the trip over. Anyhow, there was a bit of sense of deflation, and we still didn't know where we were going. We knew we were obviously going across the channel, but where, we didn't know. The next day, there was we were called to a conference by the senior officer on board, who happened to be a major in the Hussars, and he had his sergeant major with him. And we were told where we were going. The names, the French names, didn't mean very much to us. We were told we were going to land at a village called Lyon-sur-Mer. If they'd said that it's near Deauville or Le Havre, anybody who'd been lucky enough to go over there before the war would have known where we were going to land, but to us it didn't mean anything. At least to me it didn't mean anything. Remember that conference, as the sergeant major from the Hussars considered his tanks were of the primary importance and probably going to win the war by themselves, and the rest of us were just freeloaders going along for the ride. And he wanted volunteers from the rest of us who were at the conference to get out of the landing craft as it approached the shore and was presumably about to bump on the sand, and walk in front of the landing craft to find out if there are any shell holes under the water which couldn't be seen and into which his tanks might fall. He was very politely told what he could do with his tanks and all the rest of it by the Navy and by myself. And that was the only instruction about landing, because we knew what we were going to do. We set off at nightfall. It was a tremendous sight. There was a great armada of ships, so we didn't have capital ships. There were landing craft tanks, as far as the eye could see almost, and the big ships carrying the infantry with the LCAs over the side. It was a rough ride across the channel. We weren't feeling too good. And as dawn came, we heard a great noise on getting towards dawn, a tremendous noise. And we looked up, and the sky was absolutely black with aircraft. You could not, well, you could hardly see see anything for aircraft up there. It was an amazing sight. And of course, it was a very heartening sight to people who were on the ships about to land, because they knew the RAF was going to go in and absolutely knock hell out of any opposition, so we hoped. And also that the paratroopers and the gliders who were bringing up behind these L aircraft, that they would be able to secure a bridgehead. So spirits lifted a bit. The morning, it was and cloudy, a grey morning, and we came very close into the beach without any shell fire. It was almost like a classic manoeuvre in a way. We suddenly saw ahead of us smoke, grey smoke and mist mixed, and as we approached we saw the obstacles in the water, because the beach there is very shelving, very shallow for a long way out. But still there was no great sign of being attacked by anybody. And then we started noticing one or two plops in the water, which must have been mortars going in, but nothing else. Then we heard gunfire, a machine gun fire, and then it seems once we got into the smoke, we were in it. I immediately noticed over on the left a landing craft tank, which had come in alongside us and gone ahead a little. It suddenly caught fire. The whole thing seems so unreal. It's not like a battle scene as one would imagine it or seen on the film since the day. It's a very unreal atmosphere. So we got down, slight apprehension, into the half track, and we drove off without any incident. Very little water, I think it was about a couple of feet of water, and got onto the beach. And there, instead of seeing shell holes, all I saw was a very well-raked section of beach. It looked as though the whole beach looked as though it had been gone over with a rake. Then, as we came off the beach, which was about, that point, about 40, 50 yards wide, we started coming across bodies, British bodies, and the mist and the smoke was circling around. I remember the first one I saw was an infantryman. And what fascinated me was he had no head. He was just lying there with no head. There was no sign of his head. But I don't think I was particularly shocked. It sounds a cruel thing to say, but I was quite surprised not seeing much more carnage. But then as we started to get to the little sand hills, which were just below a promenade, a concrete promenade, we did start seeing bodies there and some wounded fellows and the rest. I was out of the half track by this time, and I started taking pictures of the troops coming ashore. Then I suddenly spotted two very tiny infantrymen marching along a very tall German soldier who was absolutely terrified. He had a bandage round his face, and there's these two rather cheerful, and they were Cockneys on either side of them. I said, "Just a minute." And they posed as though they might be posing in Piccadilly Circus for their picture with this German in between them. I think he was a German, though quite possibly as another nationality. They had foreign troops guarding that beach on the German side. And took the classic picture, which, I say it's a classic because it's a picture we've always been told to look out for. Captured prisoners, very good for the morale and all the rest of it over this side. By this time, the shell fire from inland in the Caen direction, near the guns on the hills, started to come down on the beach, and also rifle and automatic fire. So we started getting a little more cagey. I'd left the half track by this time, it's no more use to me, and I was on my own, as it were. And I photographed a Bren carrier blazing away merrily with troops rushing past, until somebody said, "Get the hell out of it, it's loaded with ammunition, it's likely to go up." Tried to get off the beach, and then we started to come against the real difficulty, because a flail tank, which was supposed to close the lines in the approaches, had been blown up at one of the exits, and the exits were very narrow, and nothing could get through. Consequently, you had more and more LCAs coming in with tanks and with the first vehicles and half tracks, and they were just moving up and down, keeping moving so as they wouldn't be hit. With nowhere to go, because no one could get through the minefields. And the minefields were very obvious. And then I saw some bodies of infantry who had tried to get through the minefield, but hadn't been lucky, lying in the minefield. So it was a stalemate, no one could get off. I retraced my steps along the beach to see if there was another way off to get infantry. And I caught up with an infantry platoon making an attempt to get off the beach, and all of a sudden there was a rattle of automatic fire coming from where I know not, and I felt a searing pain in my left elbow, and I didn't go down. I don't think I dropped the camera. I sort of crouched down, and I looked to my left, and the chap who had been standing on by my side, who was an infantryman, he was lying on the ground, and you could see right away he was dead. And the same burst had caught him and presumably gone straight through his heart. So I thought, well, this is a fine kettle of fish. I got my field dressing out and wrapped it round and looked for a first aid station, and I saw the Red Cross flying over a bunker which had been captured by the initial assault troops who'd used flamethrowers on it, and went up to the entrance, and an RAMC corporal there said, "What's the matter?" I said, "I've been shot through the elbow." "He said, let's have a look." "Well, come inside." I went inside, and it was like almost like a Hogarth painting. There were soldiers lying all over the place, some of them very badly wounded, you could see, with legs off and things like that. And there was a young RAMC officer, I think he was I thought he was a lieutenant, but he must have been a captain. I don't think he had a lieutenant in the RMC. And he was busy operating there, and I'm thinking that chap probably knows more, going to learn more about surgery in the next half day than he will in the rest of his life. This corporal, who was quite, used to the sight of all the blood, presumably, he said, "Here you are," and he slapped the sulfamide powder on my elbow and wrapped it around. He said, "You better get back to England." So I went out, and as I went out, I was joined by a major in the Royal Artillery, a very young fella, and he had his arm in a sling. And he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I've been told to go back to England." He says, "Well, so have I." He said, "Well, come on, best thing we can do is get down to the beach and get on the landing craft." So we walked down to the beach, and there was an LCA which had just deposited its load onto the beach, and we shouted up to the young sub-lieutenant who was on the bridge, "Can we come aboard? We've been told to go back to England." He said, "I'm awfully sorry, chaps," he said, "but I have strict instructions to take no one off the beach." And of course, we immediately again got the message. So back to near the first aid station, and we saw an ambulance there, and we said, "Well, what's going to happen to the walking wounded? Where do we go here? We're getting in the way." He said, "Well, there's the big centre further down." He said, "You walk down there." He said, "They're making preparations to evacuate people like yourself." So we walked down there, and I had the cine camera with me. I tried to use it with one hand because the action was getting brisk. This was getting about 10 o'clock in the morning, and there's a lot more stuff coming on shore. But it was useless. You couldn't handle a cine camera with one hand. Anyhow, I kept hold of it, and we got to this very big blockhouse which had the Red Cross. We came down onto it just behind the beach, so we could see it had a big Red Cross flag on the roof. And there again there was hundreds of walking wounded and chaps on stretchers, a lot of French commandos there. And we were told that we were going to be evacuated as soon as possible to get it out of the way. And whilst we were standing outside, it had turned then into a bright morning, and the mist and the smoke had cleared, though you could still hear the firing going on, but it seemed a lot more further inland. Somebody looked up and said, "Oh, look at that RAF fighter, he was coming straight along the beach." And then somebody said, "You bloody fool, that's not an RAF fighter, that's a jet plane." And we all ran for shelter in this blockhouse, and there were so many bodies trying to get into this blockhouse that those of us who were last were literally half in and half out. And I remember as this plane came along, he started firing his machine gun, and we actually saw the being kicked up by the machine gun bullets. And there were two RAMC lads carrying a wounded fellow on a stretcher, and I suppose quite naturally when they saw this and heard this, they'd the stretcher and ran. And the major, who was standing outside the blockhouse, ran out and started saying, "Come back, pick up that stretcher, I'll shoot you, I'll have you court-martialed." He was right in a way. He had to instill discipline into these chaps who, like this before, and their first thought was self-preservation. Luckily, no one was killed in that, and that was the only plane we saw during the morning. Then they started putting us on the LCAs, which had brought troops ashore, and commenced taking us out to a big Liberty ship, which was moored offshore. And by this time, as we were going out, we could see the ships of the fleet firing out at sea. But we seemed to be in very control of the situation. Let's face it, I'd only seen one German prisoner. I'd seen one dead one outside the blockhouse. And this German plane, that was all the enemy I'd seen. On the LCA, we had a lot of chaps. These were French commandos who were wounded, badly wounded. Two of them were blinded. And it was very uncomfortable for them going out because the waves were coming over the side and they were in a state of shock. But strange enough, when they were being loaded onto the LCAs, they didn't want to go. They nearly had to be forced to get onto the LCAs and be taken away. Presumably after 4 or 5 years in England and back home in the motherland, suddenly had to leave like that. Anyhow, they took us out to this Liberty ship, which was one of the ships where it was a duck. Very similar in size. It was a duck. You drive into the ship. Very unseaworthy vehicle. And they made about 3 or 4 attempts to get in because of the heavy sea running. And finally we made it. We were all absolutely soaked. And no sooner were we in than 10 minutes later, the last of these ducks, which I've been calling LCAs, came in. Then we heard the guns of the ships around us open fire, and we actually heard machine gun bullets rattling on the hull of the ship. And I think the ship was still flying had the Red Crosser. Anyhow, they set off immediately, and we landed early next morning at an East Coast port. I can't remember which one it was. I think it was quite the way around. I think it was probably one of the Thames ports, and that was our return. From there we were taken to St. Margaret's Hospital at Epping, very mixed bag. No one desperately wounded, because the really seriously wounded had been operated on the ship as we went through the night. And I don't think the hospital really knew what hit them. There were all these dirty soldiers carrying all kinds of weapons and filing in and saying, "Right, that's your bed, get into it, you see." And we stripped off and put weapons under the bed. And a surgeon came around, obviously, to see who we needed operating on. Very quickly, he was a man of about 60, and he started operating about 5 o'clock at night. I understood he operated right through the night till about 6 o'clock the next morning. I was operated on. It was quite a simple thing. I just had this bullet taken out of my elbow, and next morning I wanted to get up to phone the army film unit at Pinewood to tell them what had happened, and they let me do this, and I got on to Hugh Stewart. And I said, "This is Sergeant O'Neill." He said, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm at Epping." He said, "What are you doing in Epping? You're supposed to be in France." So I explained what had happened, and he said he would come down. I went back to the bed and got into it. Of course, my camera and my revolver were underneath the bed. And then an officer from the Royal Army Ordnance Corps came in with two sergeants and proceeded to collect all the weapons under the bed. There was a terrifying assortment. There was hand grenades, there was submachine guns fully loaded, you name it. Took an absolute armory out. And later on in the day, Hugh Stewart came down, and I gave him the camera, still with the film inside, plus another 100 foot I'd carried with me, and away he went with them. So my meeting at Calm Town Hall turned out to be a meeting a long way away at a hospital in Essex.
How many cans of film did you take with you for the D-Day landing?
Well, I think we took about 1,000 feet. And I can't quite remember what happened to the stuff I shot in the Solent on board the boat before we went off to France. I don't think I took that with me. I managed to get that ashore somehow. But certainly I think I got about 200 feet or 300 feet, possibly, of the actual landing. I think, I'm not sure, without doing a check back.
I gather that Hugh Stewart wasn't able to rush over to Epping immediately to collect the film, that he had got into some hot water with the War Office. Can you tell me more?
I learnt this later on, and apparently it was all hell let loose at the War Office, that the Americans were getting some very good stuff back from their landings, and we were getting nothing back. Well, this wasn't surprising, because there was I coming back on a hospital ship. Billy Greenhow, I later learnt, had been hit with mortar fire and was nursing his injuries on the Normandy beach before being taken off, and Jimmy Maffham had been surrounded by German tanks and had spent 12 hours, half a day, under a blown-up British tank, not daring to move. The crux of the matter, of course, was that this arrangement for meeting on the steps of Calm Town Hall on the late afternoon of D-Day just wasn't on, because 21 days later, I think, the infantry were still trying to get through to Calm Town Hall. Now, what better arrangement could have been made, I don't know. To start off with, one didn't know at the final briefing in London, before we went down to the Lager areas, where the landing was going to be made. So if you don't know where you're going to land, how can you possibly arrange to meet anybody? Let me see, if Derek Knight had come with me, how was he going to get the film back? I mean, say, we saw on the beach right away they weren't taking anybody back, even wounded. And there was no airstrip available to put it onto an aircraft. And no, I think that communications, they did possibly the best they could, but the Americans were much better organised.
You were saying earlier that the beach wasn't exactly sort of covered with the dead and dying, but towards the top of the beach there were lots of dead British soldiers lying around.
There's
and dying.
Lots of dead bodies, German, no, British chief, not German, lying in the little sand hills just below the promenade, where obviously that they'd landed, they'd rushed up the beach, got so far safely, except for a few of them, but had really been pinned down in these little sand hills, which didn't offer them very much cover from rifle fire, and certainly no cover at all from mortar or shell fire, which was on the hills behind, which could overlook the position.
Did you not think that these were worth filming?
No. No, because I suppose the old instinct came back. You photographed material which could be used, and they would not use pictures of dead bodies. Use pictures of dead Germans, but not pictures of dead British.
Was this something that came out during training, that the sort of direction would come out, or was this a general common sense rule?
I think it was a general common sense rule. I can't ever remember it being told to us specifically, don't photograph dead British, only photograph dead Germans. But I think part of the training did instill into you a very good knowledge of what was required for the job.
You yourself, or any other cameraman you knew of, did you ever come across any instance where there was direct censorship on the spot, somebody forbidding you from actually shooting a particular object or a particular scene, particular setting?
Not that I can remember. And okay, a hypothetical case, if an officer had said to me, You cannot photograph that. Even I, as a sergeant, would have been prepared to stand up to him, not say, yes, sir, touch me forelock and go away. And, you know, say, what is the reason? And if it wasn't good enough, make damn sure that it got back to our section officer and get him to raise a stink about it. But no, we didn't come across it so much. Strange enough, though, there was a war on, and one would think security was almost hypochondriac. I think that today there's more people around in 1978 telling people what they can photograph and they can't photograph than there was during the war.
You yourself would have needed to collect a good deal of reasonably top secret information in order to be on the spot to film. Was there any suggestion that if you attended a briefing with an intelligence officer telling you basic information about what was going to happen on a certain day, or such as D-Day, for example, would they themselves make steps to ensure that you didn't actually fall into enemy hands of not only dope sheets but also film on you, which would obviously show what had been going on?
No. No, I think this was presumably a hazard, and that was never allowed for. Obviously, if it had been captured, we wouldn't write up the dope sheet until late at night. We'd try and remember what it was all about. Presumably, actually, we would have the film on us, and I suppose as such we would be a prize for any intelligence. But there's no instructions ever given as to what to do in the event of imminent capture. None at all.
Do you think, in retrospect, this is a surprising omission?
Yes, I do. I do. Because, quite frankly, you could have destroyed the information very quickly. All you do was open the tin and just fling the reel out, holding one end, and there's 100 foot of, you know, useless film. Same with the camera, too. No, we were never given that. It was always a very optimistic approach. You know, you wouldn't be captured, and it's not going to happen to you. It's very optimistic all the way through. No one ever thought about being killed or wounded or captured. But an arrogant belief in our own invincibility.
You obviously weren't fit enough to carry on being an active Army Film Unit cameraman. What then happened?
Well, when I came out of hospital, I went back to Pymouth for a short stay, and then they asked me if I'd like to go and join Bill Horton at the War Office in the department which received all the still pictures back, developed them, contact printed them and distributed them to the Ministry of Information. And I joined him there and spent about, I think it was about a year there. Highlight of that, of course, was Churchill announcing victory in Europe. We knew the war was over, or practically over, and we were called to Downing Street, and I went along with Bill Horton, Major Horton as he was, and two civilian newsreel cameramen. And we took a stage picture, first of all, of Winston Churchill at the cabinet table, making the end of the war announcement. It was a dummy run. And then after taking the picture, we went outside and sat on the terrace of number 10 Downing Street. And through the open windows, open French windows, we could hear Churchill making his announcement to the nation, which I... It was quite an occasion, in more ways than one. After that, spell at the War Office, Soldier Magazine, the new paper for the Army, had been launched in Brussels, but the was very soon transferred to Hamburg, and they had quite a biggish London office, or biggish in the terms of the size of the magazine, to mastermind this. It was run by Sean Fielding, who used to be, or who was, a crime reporter on the Daily Herald, and was now a brigadier. No, he was colonel. He was colonel in the Army PR. And I joined him in Eaton Square, where Charlie Waterhouse, who had been with No. 5 unit, and Monty Berman, who'd been in Africa, were installed as still photographers. And they were much older men than myself. They were very soon due to leave the army, and I was to take their place. And so I started two and a half year stint on Soldier magazine as a soldier.